Welcome to Pop Unlock. I'm Landry Ayers.
And I'm Natalie Dowsicki.
Fire up your gene drives and hop in your spacesuits, because today we are blasting off into the 1997 artsy sci-fi box office flop turned cult classic, Gattaca. Joining us today are Associate Professor of Philosophy at the College of William and Mary, Chris Fryman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And the Richard L. Morrill Chair in Ethics and Democratic Values at the University of Richmond, Jess Flanagan.
Hi.
So given that Gattaca is set in the not-too-distant future and was released in 1997, does anyone think we're close to making Gattaca a reality? And would that be a good or bad thing?
I don't know how close we are. I don't know if we're as far away as we might think. I could see it happening in my lifetime, perhaps. And I guess I would say, you know, depending on how genetic enhancement is actually used, I think it could be a good thing on the whole to make people healthier and happier. I think that the movie raises some important moral questions about enhancement, but I don't think it's all that different from medical treatments that we use to do things like treat polio, that sort of thing. And I do have to say, I didn't realize this was a box office flop. That kind of makes me sad too, because I really like this movie.
Yeah, actually, this movie did not do very well at the box office. I believe it had a budget of something around $36 million, and it only made, throughout its whole theatrical run, I think just a little over $12 million. So it only really made back a third of its budget.
Wow.
Production-wise. So not very good investment-wise for a movie. But it's since gained a cult following for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if the question was about like just the technology, I think the barrier to making this a reality isn't like the gene editing technology. If anything, it seems like our gene editing technology is like more advanced than it was in the movie, because it looked like in the movie they were doing pre-implantation genetic selection, but now we have CRISPR. So you can like actually like affect the genomes of a future person directly without doing just the screening, where it looked like before they were doing screening. But the barrier is just the knowledge about how genes will translate to these different types of traits. And so they were assuming that they like understood how genetic information could translate to a bunch of behavioral traits like ADHD and stuff. And we just don't have a good enough understanding of like how the human genome works to know if that's feasible or if that's even how genes would work. Plus there's like epigenetic factors that would matter. So like the science isn't quite there with just understanding how genes work, but the science is farther than there when it comes to like being able to modify the genes of future people.
So like in the very first scene, or within the first few minutes of the movie, we get a scene where two parents are meeting with what would be the equivalent of a like fertility doctor. And they are given a picture with cells, or I guess they're zygotes, right? And they're told, oh, like, do you have preference of a boy or girl? And we already pre-screened for all of these different, anomalies and or different traits that they could want their children to have. And the parents make this comment about like, oh, can't we leave some things up to chance? And I was interested, since both of you are parents, if you would want to choose some of those traits, or if you would like to leave some of those traits up to chance. Now, I'm not talking about like any sicknesses or that kind of stuff, like serious disabilities. I'm more talking about things they were talking about. Like they talked about eye color and hair color. And I was kind of curious what you guys would do in that situation.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting question. I think it's nice to leave some things up to chance. So it's, you know, if you have one of these situations where it's, what do they call it? It's like a Christmas gift exchange where you're paired with another person, you exchange gifts.
Like a white elephant.
White
Secret
elephant.
Santa.
Okay. Secret Santa. But like sometimes that happens where you don't really know what the other person wants. And then so you just kind of like ask them directly what they want. You give them exactly what they want. And like, or they give you like an Amazon gift card or something like that. And there's no real surprise to it. That kind of takes the fun out of the gift exchange if you know exactly what you're going to get. And I think you could make an analogous argument with kids. It's probably good to leave some things up to chance. But like you said, I don't think you want to leave everything up to chance. So certainly things that are relevant to the child happiness or overall well-being, I think you might have good reason to tinker genetically.
But anybody who's been a parent will know that, like, there's so much stuff that's already up to chance, like, that has nothing to do with any of this, that there's already a lot of, like, surprises and unexpected stuff. And some people are critical of, like, pre-implantation enhancement because they think that that is, like, a kind of, like, parental hyper-agency. So, like, Michael Sandel teaches at Harvard, so, like, no wonder that he thinks this because, like, mm-hmm. he's surrounded by a bunch of people who maybe did have, like, hyper-gentle parents to come here. But, like, he worries that, like, if we had parents that were able to do this in addition to, like, you know, 20 hours a week for travel soccer and SAT tutoring and stuff, that it would make parents, like, less accepting of their children and that parenting should have what he calls, like, openness to the unbidden. But, you know, good parenting should have openness to the unbidden, whether or not your kids were selected or not. Like, his yeah. objections to bad parenting, not to genetic enhancement. And there's another philosopher, this guy, Julian Savulescu, and he has this analogy, the Wheel of Fortune analogy, where he's like, imagine that you had two boxes and they both, you spin a Wheel of Fortune and you could get some kind of payoff, box A and B. But if you choose box B, then you also have a one in six chance of, like, losing some money, like losing $100. And otherwise the two are exactly the same. Like, of course you would choose box A because it still has a bunch of randomness involved, but it just doesn't have this additional chance of, like, some kind of thing that you would want to avoid. And so choosing genes for, like, disease states or something like that might be like this to the extent that you see having a disease state or having even a undesirable non-disease state as, like, a kind of thing you want to avoid. That's controversial because, like, there are disability rights advocates who are like, well, you shouldn't want to avoid those things. So we could talk about that later. But the point is just, like, there's already a ton of chance, and, like, selecting against certain traits doesn't eliminate chance in parenting or amount to hyperagency or anything like that.
And I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, Jess, because specifically the disability rights issue, I think, would definitely view this film differently released today than it was released in 1997, which is, oh my gosh, over 20 years ago now?
That's
odd to think about. Specifically, I think, with the character of Eugene and the amount of agency that he has. And I'm just kind of curious, if the film were to be released today, what do you see might be some of the differences in the reactions to it that we might have now? Do you think people would take it in a different way? Do you think they would... Is there other technology that seems to be more on the sort of on the forefront and is more far-fetched than what is included in the movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, our judgments always have a kind of, like, status quo bias. And so, like, this really reflects, like, how people perceived the status quo of, like, 1997. But, like, now things are so much further along that it would maybe be perceived as, like, more plausible today because they're a little bit closer to that.
Right. I imagine that back in 1997, this was seen more like fantasy based than people would view it today had it come out today, especially with CRISPR wasn't around back in 1997. And we've obviously had huge advances since then, just in the type of technology that we use. But I think that kind of what Landry is getting at is the reaction would be more so like a techno panic than it was, I would argue, back in 1997, that somehow this Gattaca society would be, like, much worse off than the benefits it also gave us, hypothetically.
I'm not one to say much about film criticism, but it is an interesting thing about the aesthetics of this film, that it is supposed to be very futuristic. But it looks like it takes place in the 1950s. It's like it's
right.
1950s, but with, like, electric cars and genetic enhancement somehow. I'm not quite sure what the significance of that.
Right. A lot of retrofuturism.
So maybe that's supposed to, key us into the plausibility of this happening at some point within our lifetime.
Or, I mean, I was going to say, even in relation to perhaps sort of playing into the aesthetic of, I mean, when really did the eugenics movement die down? And that's a genuine question. I am not a historian based in that or understanding that at all. But I wonder if that's sort of a sort of aesthetic homage to a period where something like eugenics might be not quite looked down upon in the same manner as it is today, and sort of attempting to draw parallels between that. But I also know that the writer-director of this movie, Andrew Niccol, has also used similar aesthetic choices of retrofuturism in other movies that he's made, including a similar movie that came out actually, I think, just a handful of years ago called In Time, which stars Amanda Seyfried and Justin Timberlake, which has a great premise, I think, but isn't a great movie in and of itself. And it's actually basically a complete remake of a short film from, I think, 1987 or something like that, that they don't credit. But basically where people are genetically engineered, once again, to not age past the age of 25. And at that point, they stop aging. And there's basically a ticking time clock that everyone has. And time alive is basically used as a currency that people can exchange and use. And the wealthy accumulate not only actual money, but use the amount of time they have to, you know, accumulate power and basically become immortal, whereas the people who are living in poverty die very young, which I think is sort of an interesting parallel compared to, like, the healthy people in the world of Gattaca are, you know, in this upper class system and probably statistically would live longer simply based on their genes, whereas the people who are considered invalids would not live as long because they have things that would be seen as disabilities or deformities, et cetera.
So that raises an interesting point about Gattaca, where you always have these sci-fi movies that seem really nice on the surface, but then there's like some horrible catch lurking in the background. It's like, everybody's like super happy and they live forever, but like a supercomputer is going to torture them when they're 30 and like extract their organs for the sake of the user. Like it's like, oh, okay. But like Gattaca's not like that. It's just kind of like, you know, things are in some sense like working as you would expect them to work and there's no horrific catch. But I still think that it's meant to serve as a kind of critique of that technology.
Well, also because the sort of caste system that you see, that they hint at, you don't see too much of the marked line between the two, the valids and the invalids. It's almost exclusively operating in the world of the supposedly genetically superior. And you don't get very much of the people who are not a part of that class. You get the people who are rounded up outside the club in the, I guess it's like a concrete basketball area that they're playing at. Or I think there's hints of some people that are at that sort of speakeasy like place that they visit together. And then there's Eugene, who sits all alone at home. But it sort of leads me to the other idea I had, which is I wanted more Eugene. I wanted more of his struggle and his decision of what it was like for Jude Law to align himself with Ethan Hawke's character. And you get moments of that where he talks about he gets 10 or 20% of the cut from the broker, Tony Shalhoub's character. Also, the cast for this movie, just
fabulous.
Stunning. Yes, bar none. Yes. And produced by Danny DeVito. Did not realize
that.
I would like to see more of both sides of the coin there. And I think that would have fleshed out the movie more for me.
Well, this might seem like a really simple question, but what exactly is Gattaca? So is it a private company? I don't think we have enough information. Maybe the movie doesn't purposely makes it a bit more nuanced what exactly Gattaca is. And I saw Jess had written in her notes, like, is Gattaca like NASA? Because then then there gets into all these interesting questions about like what your employer is and isn't entitled to, because essentially the employer is taking all of your genetic information, which sounds terrible. But I was just, I don't know if anyone else saw that nuance, like in Gattaca being a private company or it being something that's like a government hybrid or government funded company, and how that presents even more questions.
Yeah, I had this thought like watching it again, because maybe this is just because like political philosophy has like wrecked my brain when I watch movies. But I was like, first of all, for the broker's contract, like that would be prohibited now, I think, based on like the unconscionability doctrine, because it would be like a prohibited mm-hmm. contract where it's like you can't extract a percentage of somebody's lifetime earnings for some type of exchange. Like, I don't think that the courts would uphold that kind of contract. And then he's like, well, yes, genetic discrimination is illegal, but like everybody does it. And then they're like citing insurance. But like, if they're citing insurance, that might be because of like things like the Affordable Care Act, which like kind of reinforce our employer mandated insurance system. So like you could decouple insurance, the provision of insurance, from like where you go to daycare or where you work. And like, they don't necessarily have to go together, but it sounds like there's like some kind of government regulation that has these types of insurance mandates. And like, maybe if it was a public daycare, they would have had sovereign immunity, so they could have taken him. I don't know. And then, yeah, like if Gattaca is like NASA, then like that also means that like, who are the villains? Say that Gattaca is like NASA, then the villains in the movie are like the police and like this state-funded research organization. I mean, people kind of, I think the surface reading of it is like, oh, this is like a cautionary tale about like unregulated access to medical technology. But like right. the actual like second line reading of it might be like, this is a cautionary tale about like how people respond to introductions of like new genetic technology, and that like people will use public institutions to respond to it in a really problematic way. The villain is politics or people. The villain's not like the technology itself. It's not the enhancement that's the villain.
I nominate Jess to enact regulatory reform for the world of Gattaca.
So do you think, talking about this idea, we're going back a little bit, about being able to enhance your children, and so that they can go and work at somewhere like Gattaca, or they could go and the presumption is that they could go and they're going to live a better life if you enhance them. Is it so, if you kind of extract from that, is it morally permissible for parents not to enhance their children at that point? Because if everyone's enhancing their children, and you're like working backwards, if everyone's enhancing their children and then you don't enhance your children because you think like, okay, we're going to leave something up to chance, does that mean your child is like already starting further back than everyone else? And then did you like not do your duty as a parent?
I mean, I'm pretty like, I kind of feel like the bar for parenting is like pretty, it doesn't require that you do the most, because you've provided the necessary conditions for your kid to have like a whole lifetime worth living. And so I don't think that parents have a duty to like maximize the expected welfare in their child's life. There are these cases in bioethics of people who select in favor of certain disabled traits. So they'll select in favor of deafness, for example. And I don't think that they do anything wrong to deliberately decide to have a child that's deaf. The thing that people do to deaf people that's wrong is that they uphold a discriminatory set of institutions that like require like an oralist culture, or that like exclude deaf people from being able to participate in things by like not providing closed captioning and stuff. But like, mm-hmm. it's not wrong to create a child who's deaf. It's wrong to be mean to people who are deaf.
Hmm.
Right. That's the thing that's wrong.
Right.
Jess, do you mind if I follow up with a question as somebody who's probably more sympathetic to welfare maximization than you are?
That's definitely true.
So let's table the discussion of which particular traits are welfare maximizing. Let's just assume that we know what they are. And okay. Suppose you have a choice. So you say, okay, I can send my kids to one of two schools. They're identical in all respects, except the second school will increase their welfare relative to the first school. Doesn't it seem like you should send them to the second school?
There's a difference between like what you like have most reason to do versus like what's permissible. But like, it's definitely permissible for you to send them to the less welfare maximizing school. So if you're like, yeah, but like the less happy school takes 5 minutes off my commute, it's not a big commute. But like, that's fine. Cause like, you know, your kid's gonna have a life worth living. And I think that like one thing that makes people like stress out
even like just today about parenting and having more kids and stuff is that we do expect parents to just like do all that it takes and like hyper maximizing for their kids' well-being and stuff. But I think that, as long as they have lives that are worth living and that are good lives and, you know, their parents love them and stuff, you don't have to be a maximizer when it comes to parenting. And I don't think that, you know, Vincent's parents in the movie did wrong by him by creating him without enhancements. I think that the social institutions that excluded him from employment and also, like, we should talk about how the economy works in this society, but like that, those are the people who did him wrong, not his parents that created him. His parents did him a favor. Like, he should be grateful to his parents.
Let me follow up though with a question then about Vincent. So suppose Vincent is born and they get that readout that says his life expectancy is 30 years because he has a heart problem, but it's still presumably a life worth living. And suppose the doctor says, well, here's a very simple pill you can give baby Vincent. Well, maybe you don't want to give a baby a pill, but like here's a very simple injection you can give baby Vincent that will fix his heart problem and extend his life to 60 years. It seems to me like you at least have a defeasible obligation to do that if you're Vincent's parents, don't you?
I think they definitely have reasons to do it because you have moral reasons to like create more welfare if you can, or more life expectancy if you can. But I don't know that they're like required to do it or that they'd be blameworthy for not doing it. But that's a little bit different from like creating Vincent in the first place because like he didn't exist before. So like benefiting an existing person is different than creating a new person to get a certain group of benefits.
Right. I agree.
This makes me think, Jess, that you brought up specifically that the issues in dealing with people, like for instance, people who are deaf, most of the issues deal with the way that people and institutions treat them, not in the inherent status of that person. So are his parents more or less defensible because of what they then chose to do for their second son? And not necessarily in the fact that they, you know, genetically enhanced him prior to birth, but that they treated him differently? Or was it just that they were trying to warn Ethan Hawke's character about how hard his place in the world was going to be? Like his dad said, like, the only way you're going to get in there is by cleaning the bathrooms or what he said. Is there a line between those two that makes them more or less defensible, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, like, the thing that was not good parenting was, like, having this kind of approach to their children where they approach their children as like a bundle of traits rather than as people. You know, it's kind of like approaching their children instrumentally. And I don't think that that's like a good way to treat anybody, much less your own children. But creating the children as they did, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with either choice.
This conversation kind of goes well into how this movie like handles discrimination. So I saw that Chris had wrote something about genoism and like wrongful discrimination in terms of like who is like held back from certain jobs just because now we have all these enhanced people that should be better at jobs than others and won't necessarily give the chance to someone like Vincent. Now, do we think this is like wrongful discrimination? I think I saw that Chris wrote down an interesting analogy to the NFL, and I kind of wanted him to kind of tease that out for us.
Yeah, I know. I always think in terms of analogies to sports. Jess thinks about like regulatory reform. I think about the NFL. That's how my mind works. Yeah, so you know, you hear these like crazy stories about college football players who are competing to be drafted into the NFL and what sorts of things that NFL scouts do to, you know, prior to selecting them. So, you know, I think that this link that I posted is something about like the measurement of like their knees and like somehow like the width of your wrist predicts your ability to like put on muscle mass. I don't know, but really kind of crazy stuff like that. And so you might say, okay, is that a sort of a permissible reason to select one football player over another. You say like their wrist size is quote unquote better. Well, you might mm-hmm. say if it speaks to their ability to do the job better, that's a permissible reason. Maybe it's not an all things considered reason, but it seems like it's permissible because it seems what you might call occupationally relevant. It's relevant to the occupation. And so you could right. say, well, for certain things like, I think maybe another example of this would be something like being a pilot for the Air Force, or maybe just being a pilot in general, you have to, your vision has to be sufficiently good. And you say, okay, that strikes me as pretty plausible because that's occupationally relevant. And so I think you could make the case that the sorts of traits that Gattaca was looking for are permissible bases for hiring. Now, maybe they missed something by excluding the grit of Vincent, kind of like, you know, Notre Dame and Rudy. I don't know if you've seen the movie Rudy, but maybe it's kind of like that. But maybe it's not, maybe, you know, that they're missing something. I think that's like kind of part of the message of the movie, which is not everything that counts is going to be on that genetic profile that the machine spits out.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that you brought up this idea of like what the movie means as a whole too, because like Vincent's whole character is built off this idea that like you can defy the odds, right? You can disprove what the machine tells you. In terms of like, there's that great scene when he's running on the treadmill and has like the other guy's like heart monitor on, and he's like running back to the locker room after he's like completely out of breath, but tries to remain super cool and not show anyone that like he's not who he says he is, and other small scenes like that. But I think the whole point of Vincent's character really is to show this idea of like defying the odds, fighting the establishment, maybe even and that kind of plays out in those like the swimming scenes with his brother that I was kind of hoping we could talk about, especially like from the first one, from the difference between the first one and the second one.
I will say I'm old enough to have purchased the DVD of Gattaca when it came out, and the tagline on the DVD was, "There is no gene for the human spirit."
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, maybe like the swimming thing or like with the, there's no gene for the human spirit. Like that's like a nice thing to think, but I think Chris is right. Like, in America, so like take like the NBA, 17% of American men who are between the ages of 20 and 40 who are over 7 feet tall are in the NBA. So like, you know, like of the people who are that tall for like, and like, we don't know what the genes are that lead to height. So like, I mean, we know kind of like, it's like, so Gattaca, like you wouldn't be able to genetically engineer a kid right now that was like over 7 feet tall, but like, that's a huge advantage if you want to be good at basketball. Like, and there are exceptions, like there are people who are like 5'7" and they're like really good at basketball and stuff. But you know, like being super tall is like a definite advantage if you want to play in the NBA. Yeah. And like, I don't know that it's like fair to be like, but like, if you just have enough grit and like human spirit, like you too can be in the NBA if you're 5'7". Cause like, probably not.
No, you
like,
can't.
I don't know anything about sports, but like, I don't know. I assume that like all those tall people are in the NBA for a reason related to basketball.
But if you just never save anything for the swim back, Jess, then you can make it.
You can do
that's,
it too.
That's the moral of the movie, right? Like, how am I was really wondering how I was supposed to read that at the end. Was it supposed to be like this triumph of the human spirit, like you said, that which there is apparently no gene for? Or is there a sort of self-determination aspect that is sort of, you know, they want to play up and make be a sort of a theme of the movie that they want people to walk away with? But it's also like you have to sacrifice everything in order to get that. So it's not like Ethan Hawke gets everything he wants in the end. He abandons the world that he's known. He doesn't get to stay with Uma Thurman, who is apparently someone that he has grown interested in just before leaving for Titan, I don't understand why, because I don't get the Uma Thurman character in this movie at all. I don't think it's super compelling, their relationship. I would like more of the Jude Law stuff. She's just kind of placed in there, and she doesn't really do much other than act as a love interest for him, and which is, I think, really squandering Uma Thurman's abilities. I think it's they do not make efficient use of her, and I don't think the character is written well, but it. Moving back to Ethan Hawke's character, I It seems to me like he has to sacrifice everything in order to self-determine himself to a certain degree.
That movie is where he and Uma Thurman got together, and then subsequently Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman were married.
Really?
Yeah.
This is the movie where it happened? This started it?
Yeah. But then they got divorced after like a bunch of infidelity rumors about Ethan Hawke. So maybe it's not like a happy story about the movie. See, Chris has four.
And then she made Kill Bill, and yeah. It was all about that. This goes to another discussion that we had talked about, which is the interpretation of the ending. And Chris and Jess, you guys both seem to have some different sort of interpretations. So I would like to sort of discuss and sort of tease out what you guys, how you both came to the conclusions. So at the end of the movie, Ethan Hawke's character has, spoiler alert,
23 years this later. Far,
he has escaped the investigation that, spoiler alert again, his brother has been heading this whole time for the murder of the director of the program that is he has been selected for, that will take him on one of the dozen or so space expeditions to Titan. And he now he's passed the test. He is through the door. You find out the doctor has known all along that he is not who he says he is. And due to reasons like his son being not genetically enhanced and other things that go unspoken, he lets him through. Ethan Hawke gets on the plane, blasts off into space. And we see the stars come into view as Jude Law's character commit suicide. And does he cremate himself what was that chamber in his house? Was it a fireplace?
Yeah, it's like where he like destroyed all of his own genetic material. Like he would like scrub Got off it. And then he'd like incinerate his genetic material to like,
oh, that's right, so that he could protect himself. I forget. Yes. Why did you so if you could each explain how you came to interpret the ending the way you did and why.
So I don't know that it's like 100%, but I took it that in the ending, it's supposed to be ambiguous whether or not Ethan Hawke's character, Vincent, is going to die in space. Because it's cut in a way where it's like interspersed with Jude Law killing himself, and there's like a parallel between them. And then there's that whole thing of like, I won't need the samples when I get back, or like, that's not necessary. And then like also the stuff of like, I never saved anything for the way back. And so like, he knows right. that his heart condition's overdue. He didn't save anything for the way back. Like, I think he's going to die in space. And if that's the case, then that's like a really like kind of subversive thing to put in a movie. That's like the top line interpretation of the movie is that it's a warning about genetic enhancement. But then like at right. the very end, it like sows these seeds of doubt where it's like, but wait a minute, like, is that guy going to die on Saturn? Like the moon of Saturn? Because if so, then like that seems like it would have been relevant to the mission, and like this other guy killed for the mission. Like it was a very important mission, and then like Ethan Hawke gets up there and like his heart doesn't work or something. And so I thought it was like it was left ambiguous whether or not he dies in space, because he's like not leaving anything for the way back, and then it makes you question the overt message of the movie. But maybe I'm like reading too much into it.
So I love the end. I love the scene with the doctor at the end. That's just, it makes me verklempt every time I watch it. I really do. And also with the thing with the Jude Law suicide. So it just occurred to me, so you're saying like Ethan Hawke is like clipping his fingernails in an incinerator. And so if he like bumps the wrong button with his elbow while he's grooming himself in the movie, like that's not like, yeah, they need better OSHA regulations or something, I think. So I sort of interpreted it as like pretty. So I confess, I've watched this movie a bunch of times, and I never thought that Vincent was going into space with thinking that he would die there. So I think he, you know, he recognizes that that's a real possibility. But I spoke with other people, and I think I'm in the minority opinion here. I think a lot of people think that he basically did say, look, I'm going up there. And like you said, Jess, you know, he doesn't save anything for the swim back. And so he's not anticipating coming home from Titan. I think that's plausible, but I think it's ambiguous. And so there's the comment too, where he says to Jude Law, after Jude Law does all the, you know, packs the blood and urine for him for the next year. He goes, oh, that's not necessary. I always interpreted mm-hmm. that as just, you know, he's being common courtesy or something like that. I think it was him, but maybe I'm just a starry-eyed optimist.
Well, I see what you mean, because I also interpreted it at the one point as his entire goal for so long was to get into space and to go to Titan. And maybe by the time he comes back and is no longer on there, he's accomplished all that he wants to. And at that point, whatever happens, happens. And he won't need that because he is sort of given up on the need for Jude Law's DNA, perhaps.
And I think there's also there's something where Vincent sort of suggests that he's come to terms with the fact that he will get found out or something like that at some point. Like it mm-hmm. might, so it's probably, you know, I don't know what the plans are once they're up there, but it might be harder for him to deceive people without the help of everything he has at home too.
Well, presumably they're not doing like a bunch of like genetic testing while in space, because like why will they? Because like they know that nobody's going to come in or like, you know, so.
They might hear him huff and puff though. I don't know.
Yeah.
That was like, come on, I'm not sure.
Oh my gosh. How awkward will that be? Like he's like on his way to the moon of Saturn and he's like having an asthma attack or something. And he's like, oh guys, while we're here, I brought crosswords along. And also I have something to tell you.
Well, kind of something we haven't touched on yet, but there's this tension throughout the movie that I think the movie has a larger message about as well, is this idea of perfection. So the movie is suggesting that like the more perfect or the closer to perfection you can either make your child to grow up and live the longest life possible, or they can have this crazy IQ, perfect vision, all that kind of stuff, is perfection leads to happiness, or like perfection maximizes happiness. And I don't necessarily believe that, but I was wondering if anyone else saw that tension and kind of what the role perfection plays throughout the movie, or like perceived perfection.
Yeah, well, it's definitely supposed to kind of play into that like idea that it's a mistake to strive for perfection. And like when Michael Sandel, that anti-genetic enhancement guy I was talking about earlier, when he made mm-hmm. his case against genetic enhancement of embryos, like pre-implantation enhancement, he called it, as an article in The Atlantic, called The Case Against Perfection. And then also Ethan Hawke's character says that like his brother suffered under the burden of perfection. And so there is this kind of like theme of like parents are like screwing up their kids by like trying to demand perfection, because they think that that's like a return on their investment in like genetic enhancement or something. And so maybe like giving more of these possibilities, the thought is that that's just like corrupting to the parent-child relationship. But then that's just two separate questions. Like one question is like, should we have things that make people, you know, have access to genetic technology? And then how should we respond to it? And like the problem with perfectionism is about people's response to it. It's not a problem with the genetic enhancement itself, right?
Right.
Like the burden of perfection doesn't come from being genetically enhanced. It comes from people treating you differently.
Right. It comes from the response, or even the expectations that someone would then have of you knowing that you're genetically enhanced in some way or some way, shape or form. I just thought it was interesting that perfection was just like woven, or like our attitudes towards perfection were just kind of woven throughout the film in a way that I don't necessarily think they overtly talked about, other than like his brother facing the pressures of being perfect and that kind of stuff. But I just thought that theme was more interesting.
Part of it's like positional goods. Like there are some goods that like the value of the good depends on whether or not you have more of it than somebody else, and not just on like the raw value of it. So like education mm-hmm. is plausibly like that. So it's kind of like an arms race.
Right.
And I think when we talk about enhancement, we think a lot about those positional goods, things like getting a prestigious job or like a highly selective job, like being in Gattaca or something. SAT prep classes. Like if nobody mm-hmm. took SAT prep classes, if nobody went to private schools, then in some ways, like it would like level the playing field in some sense. And so like whenever we think about like hyper-parenting or like the quest for perfection, it's often these positional goods. But what we don't realize is that like health or education or work, they have non-positional values. So like there's also like good things about you know, a private school or, you know, learning more education and stuff or having better health, that don't, those good things that don't come from being better than other people, but they're just like good in themselves in like a non-positional way. But like, I think so people get hung up on the egalitarian aspect of it.
Yeah.
So that actually speaks to something that, here's maybe the one thing I really didn't like about the movie. So just to backtrack a little bit. So I think that maybe what's most prominent about the movie is sort of the social dimensions of genetic enhancement. But I think also one way of interpreting its message is as a moral one, which is like, what should you focus on in life? Should you focus on, you know, your eye color, your height, et cetera, or should you focus on some kind of moral purpose in the way that Vincent does? I think that's maybe almost like a stoic theme where you say, well, look, all this stuff that's in my genes can help in certain ways, but that's not really what's important. What's really important is kind of how I make use of what I'm given, how I play the hand I'm dealt. And it's interesting on the competitive part, what really upsets Eugene is that he came in second in the swimming competition.
Right.
And you think, well, should that, but like, what if you used your gifts to their utmost extent and you still came in second? Should you feel any shame in that? And I would say no. But then what really gets me is at the end, when Vincent and his brother have the confrontation in Gattaca, and Vincent says, or, you know, you needed help swimming that one day. And then his brother says, do you want me to prove it to you that I could beat you now? And Vincent says something like, I don't want to race again. It's forgotten. It should have ended there. But then he actually goes and tries to race his brother again to prove that he's faster than his brother. And that always bothered me. He should have just said, no, it's like beating you is no longer what's important to me. My goal is, you know, being the best astronaut that I can be. But he still had to prove that he could beat his brother in a competition. I didn't like that.
Yeah, I didn't read Vincent as being a non-positional person throughout, though. Like, oh, I just want to, like, I thought that he wanted to, like, also get into this selective program and like do this thing. I didn't think it was just about like the purely non-positional value of being in a rocket.
But do you think he wanted to get into the program to be at the top of the food chain? I always interpreted it as, you know, because in the beginning he's like looking up at the stars and he's admiring space and all this stuff. I always took that to be his primary motivation.
Yeah.
Like he just wanted to go out in the stars.
Yeah, like I think that the dream.
Yeah, the Eugene narrative goes in the opposite direction. Like Eugene comes to terms with it. Like he comes to terms with the non-positionality at the end of his life because he like puts the medal on and then he's like, oh, like that was like, there was a kind of non-positional value to like what my life was about.
And he also suggests that what gives his life meaning at the end is the fact, in the end, is the fact that he was able to kind of share Vincent's purpose.
Oh, that's true. Like you lent me your dream, that whole part.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I also thought what was a bit more interesting, and we haven't talked about him in length, but many of us noted this idea that like once Eugene was no longer able to like use his enhanced body because he got in an accident, which was also due to sports. But side note, he kind of just like he gives up in a sense. And he was like, okay, well, I'm going to sell my genetic material essentially so that someone else can get better use of it or get better use of my identity. And then he like becomes an alcoholic and like a chain smoker, which is interesting because I just think it's like at tension that he just basically gave up because he got in this accident. But I don't know. What did you guys think of that? I know we all noticed like, why is he now like gone full swing?
Well, then Ethan Hawke was also chain smoking at times. Like he's about to go to space.
Yeah.
And he's and I'm like, dude, and they test for all these different things, but it's literally like he's one of those people that's like, well, I passed my drug test, time to go smoke a bunch of cigarettes. Like I don't understand the rationale that went on where he was like, all right, it's done, it's out of the way, I'm an astronaut and I'm never gonna get tested ever again.
Well, it's because it looks cool. Remember that scene where he like blows the smoke into the wine glass?
Right.
That's true. If the 90s media taught us anything, it's that smoking looks cool.
They would not be vaping.
Right.
I do think that, like, what's going on with that is that, like, is supposed to play into this idea that like people who are enhanced, like focusing on genetic enhancements prompts a kind of instrumental orientation towards somebody where you see them as like a bundle of useful traits. And then when he no longer saw himself as a bundle of useful traits, he just focused on things that were non-instrumentally valuable. So just like pleasure seeking. Sure. So like getting drunk, being with sex workers, chain smoking, like those are things that are like not going to like advance his position in any way, but were just like pleasurable for him. And so he kind of like took a non-instrumental view of his life in that way. Once he could no longer like fulfill what he viewed as like the instrumental value of his genetic lot.
Right.
So it makes sense for him. I don't know why Vincent's smoking. I thought that too, because I was like, you're about to go in space and you have a heart condition. Maybe lay off vodka.
He's under a lot of pressure. He's going to blow off some steam. He's got to relax.
Right.
Can we talk about the economy and like what's going on in the economy of the society?
Sure.
Well, also my like, okay, so my biggest question was like, how many space missions is Gattaca running? Because like the whole, like, what was it, like 12 rockets or something? Like
12 a month or something.
Yeah, right?
A day.
And I was like trying to think in my head, I was like, man, this is like millions upon billions of dollars. They're just like shooting this up into space.
Remember, it's a not too distant future. This is Space Force.
Right.
This is what's going to happen.
Right. You're right. And then like the other thing that I was thinking about throughout the movie is that if we got to a point in Gattaca that we were living in a world with Gattaca, and people were genetically enhancing their children, I imagine that it at least would start off as something that was not accessible to lower or middle class families. It would only be something that was accessible to people that would pay for the purpose of this, which is interesting because I do not think that, though it's not explicitly said, it did not seem like Vincent's parents were necessarily well off. But I don't know. How did you guys interpret the economy of Gattaca?
Yeah, two things. So like the first is, presumably like if it's an economy that's like rich enough to be sending all these rockets up into space, they could also have like disability basic income or like a basic income for people who are unenhanced and like lack access to employment. And they could probably like invent some robots that would like clean the office buildings for them instead of having like this kind of permanent underclass that's like doing the office work. And so this is like yet another like case about like automation. And then, you know, if someone gets injured and they break their back and they can't work, like they could get a basic income. They wouldn't have to like sell their genetic material. So I am like wondering, and like what, like how does the economy work such that society is not rich enough to include any kind of like support system, but they are rich enough to like send a bunch of rockets into space. It doesn't make any sense. Alan Buchanan's like a philosopher that writes about like what would happen if we had like post-humans that were like really enhanced and like way genetically advantaged relative to unenhanced people. And he says like, in order for institutions to be justifiable, people who are really disadvantaged by a system that like cedes a lot of socioeconomic power and political power to the enhanced, then the enhanced people would have a moral obligation to kind of like cut everybody else in on the benefits of the enhanced society, like the society that was run by enhanced people. And so I don't know if I like think that that's the reason, but I do think that it's kind of just like a kind of unstable system to have this extremely wealthy society that like nevertheless doesn't like kind of provide any sort of compensation or assistance or anything to unenhanced people, but actually like engages in active discrimination of them. And then the second thought about the economy is just like, it does seem like, you know, it's broadly egalitarian in terms of access, but even if you were worried about like inegalitarian access to enhancements, that's true of any kind of healthcare innovation. Like, you know, in the beginning, drugs are really expensive. And then they like go generic, or the technology gets cheaper, the price goes down, and then everybody can share in the benefits. So sometimes people like object to enhancement because they worry it'll heighten economic inequality. But you know, you could subsidize it or more generally just wait until the technology gets cheaper and then everybody can share in it. That's not a reason to block emerging technologies early on. Like computers, like if there was a requirement that computers were affordable to all families back in like 1989, like we would never have computers, but now, like, you can get a computer for like $150, and it's like, yeah, so.
And I think there's also a question of what kind of comparison is the morally important one. So the movie focuses on the comparison between Vincent and people like Eugene and his brother. But you might think that the relevant comparison is not Eugene versus Vincent, but say Vincent versus what Vincent would be like or what his life would be like in a world without enhancement. So you might say, like, today, I'm a lot worse off than Jeff Bezos. But I'm a lot better off for being in a world with all of these positive externalities, so that, you know, food and shelter and transportation and medical technology is really abundant. So it's better to be middle class or even relatively poor in 2020 than in 1920, in part because of things like technological advancements. And so I think it's plausible that, like, if you had maybe a more accurate depiction of what an enhanced world would be like, that Vincent, as he is, would be better off in the enhanced world than in the unenhanced world. So like, similar to these points, we say, like, look, Gattaca's launching 12 rockets a day. Surely they're going to have, like, cheap tickets for space tourism or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
go to the moon. Right. Really,
the stars, like, it'll cost them, you know, $15 to go to Mars or something like that. And you say, that's not as good as being a commander at Gattaca or whatever his title was going to be, but it's better than he would be if he wasn't in this world of, technological advancement and genetic enhancement and things like that. Because it's weird, like, he can't even get LASIK. Tony Shalhoub is like, no, we can't give you this surgery because it'll give you scars or something like that. You say, I think in that world, he would probably have far more opportunity as a result of living in a society with all of these super smart people who are generating all these positive externalities.
That's another thing. It seems like the smart people or the enhanced people, they should be generating more positive externalities, because, like, if you were doing enhancement, and some of the enhancements they mentioned, like tendencies to, like, violent aggression, I think was one of them or something, like,
yeah,
are moral enhancements. Like, so, like, why wouldn't you enhance people to make them more ethical? So you could give people, like, enhanced cooperative abilities, enhanced empathy, enhanced generosity. But it seems like all of the people who are enhanced are, like, total assholes to other people. And it's just like, why would you think that enhancing people would make them morally, like, still be really morally problematic and, like, an egalitarian, when, you know, why not enhance for more cooperation and empathy?
Well, why wouldn't they enhance then to make everyone moral saints? Because then you wouldn't have any issues.
I mean, there is a question about whether or not it's desirable to have moral saints, or if there's, like, other good stuff that you might want to have, like, I don't know, interior designing or architecture or something. But
right.
But, like, yeah, you could make them, if not moral saints, like, morally better. But it seems like the enhanced people are, like, really morally bad. Like, they look upon the unenhanced with contempt, which does not seem like it would be compatible with having enhanced empathy or cooperation or anything like that.
Yeah, we could bump up empathy by, like, at least 20% in that movie.
Yeah. at least.
Everything's negotiable except for the fact that, like, people are going to be self-interested and mean to people. And then it's like, that's the thing that, like, we can't find a way around that in some way. But we know the genetic basis for literally everything else, which is just like.
Well, and Jess, I know this is something that you talk about, this the reversal test, but on the point of the positive externalities, you could say, well, you know, ask ourselves if we would prefer to live in a world in which, say, you know, every Nobel Prize winner was disenhanced. I don't know if that's the word. Would we be better or worse off for living in that world? It seems like we would be worse off living in that world, because we say, look, there are all these positive externalities that come about from these really exceptional people. Then if you think that's the case, you might ask, well, okay, then why not expect to be bumped up ourselves by having even more of these exceptional people, or making the exceptional people even more acceptable? Though if we're not willing to disenhance because we think that would be bad for us, then we might ask, well, okay, let's be more, you know, why aren't we more open to further enhancements? It would be a semi-miraculous coincidence if we landed on the exact right amount of ability that was the status quo.
Right.
Right. Yeah. The reversal test is nice because it's like, how would you argue that the status quo is optimal? And, like, in some ways, our society is already enhanced because life expectancy has increased so much. And so, like, say that we had a genetic enhancement that would increase life expectancy to 130. People are like, oh, no, that would be so terrible because It's like that movie In Time. It's like, oh, we need to like keep the population down somehow because we don't want to have too many people hanging around or something. okay, but like if that's a reason, then like why wouldn't we just like stop pursuing things that would extend life now? Or like why wouldn't we actually just stop providing things that extend life after 60 or 70 years old? And then people are like, oh no, that would be like really monstrous. But like the same reasons that you wouldn't want to like scale back life expectancy, because that seems terrible, would also be reasons to increase it. And then that's true for just all of the stuff. Like, why think that, you know, in 1997, we reached the optimal level of enhancement. That was perfect. But anything beyond that is just going to end in disaster. Like, it's our own status quo bias. Just like even how you perceive the status quo, it's like, there is not really like one status quo. Like, I was at a conference once and there were like, I was in a breakout group and there were like three different groups of people. And like one group was from like a disability rights community. And they were talking about CRISPR. And they were saying like, we should be like extremely reluctant to allow any more like human trials or any kind of experimentation with humans in CRISPR, because it's going to lead to this kind of like worry about the specter of eugenics. And then there were like some physicians, and physicians were like, well, we should look into it, but we shouldn't be doing it yet. We should have lots of guardrails on it. We should kind of proceed within the medical establishment through hospitals and IRB trials with lots of safeguards. And then there were some like tech people who were like, every day that we wait on CRISPR is a day that like we're going to lose lives that could have been saved with like the innovations that CRISPR will bring. And all three of those groups were just like trying to maintain the status quo that they saw. So like the disability rights people were just trying to like maintain the status quo distribution of ability and resources for people of different abilities. And the doctors were trying to maintain what they saw as like the status quo distribution of medical treatments and like kind of go through that ordinary system. And then like the tech people were trying to maintain their like status quo pace of innovation, which was like Uber and then like Facebook comes and, you know, like accelerating innovation. But that was like all the status quo, but it was just like, depending on where you were sitting, that influenced how you saw things. And like in 1997, and even today, like people see the status quo and they only look at like the position, the way that things look. But we don't see that like part of our status quo is that things are changing all the time. That's also the status quo. Like the speed of innovation is also the status quo.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you make an important point about the status quo already being enhanced above and beyond the natural. So if we think of an enhancement as just something that takes us beyond, you know, I don't know, the evolved nature of Homo sapiens or something like that. I mean, that ship has sailed for that, you know, for a long time. So like I use this example with my students. It's like, suppose, I don't know when fluoride was invented or maybe not, you know, whenever it was introduced into toothpaste. Like, would you object to brushing your teeth with fluoride because it gives you an enhanced resistance to cavities? It's like, that doesn't strike me as like a very compelling objection to fluoride use. And now like every, and like, in fact,
why
today,
do you want to play God, Brian?
Exactly. Dentists are playing God with our children's teeth. I've been saying it for a long time. And like, you would be weird if you said that. But we say like, look, because we take it as normal now that you can enhance your teeth or you vaccinate and this enhances your health beyond what's natural. And so I think it's very, very hard to draw a principled line between what counts as an enhancement and what's not. I mean, you know, binoculars are an enhancement in a certain sense. And that so, yeah, true. I think I there's a tendency to think like, oh, no, like what we have now is perfectly natural and it's normal. They're like, no, not really. Like you go back 1,000 years and it would look very, very weird to them.
This movie does have some like strong, like anti-vax, anti-GMO energy, right?
Oh, for sure.
I hadn't seen it that way.
Well, so this is the, you know, interesting is because Vincent is referred to as like a god child, which seems to suggest that what the enhanced people are doing is like is playing God in an objectionable way.
And now for the time in the show where we all get to share the other pieces of media that we have been enjoying during this period at home. This is Locked In. So, Natalie, Jess, Chris, what else have you been enjoying?
So what have I been reading lately? I read Zena Hitz's book, Lost in Thoughts, which is kind of like a pop philosophy type book. That was like pretty fun. I liked that. It has like lots of good stories. And I've been listening to Phoebe Bridgers has a new album out.
Yeah, very good.
It's very good. Mm-hmm. And The Mountain Goats. have a new album that recently came out that he just kind of like recorded in his house. And I think that that album is also really excellent. It's like a concept album based off of like a French historian's account of like the last day of the last like kind of days of the pagans, or like the last groups of pagans that were like kind of swept up with Christianity. But it's like an album around that. It's really good. So the Mountain Goats new album is good. And Frank Turner, who I like, maybe I bet some of your listeners will like Frank Turner also, but he's been doing like these little like live things, and he did one that was like all covers. And I thought that was really good. So if you follow Frank Turner on Twitter, he'll like link to like these little live YouTube shows that he's been putting on. And those have been pretty charming. I don't know. I've been reading some poetry that I like, which is like Tony Hoglund. He recently died. He's a really good poet. And I just read What Narcissism Means to Me, which is like a really good book of his poetry. So I would recommend that too. But cool. Yeah, that's what I've been up to lately.
I don't really enjoy reading all that much, so I don't know if I have any book recommendations. So I do like to watch TV, so I could maybe give some TV recommendation. So here's one. I have to preface this by saying, so my wife recommended this to me, and her pet peeve is when she makes a recommendation and I resist the recommendation thinking that I won't like it. And eventually I relent and I love it. And this is one of those cases. So she kept pushing the show on me, telling me I would love it. And finally I gave in and I do love it. It's called Dave. And it's on Hulu.
Oh my gosh.
You know the show? It's incredible.
Yes.
Here's how I describe it. It's like Curb Your Enthusiasm if Larry David were a rapper in his 20s. It's great.
Little Dicky. He made the show. Little Dicky, I've seen it.
Exactly. It's so good. So I definitely recommend that. And that's maybe like
a Wait, Little Dicky's in the show?
Yeah. So Little Dicky's the main character.
Oh my gosh, Richmond.
And he's the executive producer. And he also graduated from the University of Richmond.
Yeah, University of Richmond.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Probably the like the famous Richmond grad, Little Dicky right there.
Yeah. You should be proud. He's great. It's hard to tell exactly how much of the show reflects reality, because in the show he seems very confident that he is in fact a talented rapper, and my wife claims that in reality he also thinks he's a talented rapper. Like, it's not tongue-in-cheek. I don't know, Natalie, if you've seen the show, what do you think? Do you think he really believes he's a good rapper? I mean, maybe he is, I don't know.
So like Little Dicky's whole vibe is this, like, that he's a good rapper but doesn't fit in with like the stereotypical rapper, like the stereotype of good rappers. And he, like, I believe, because he's an executive producer on the show too, I believe at least the first season is supposed to reflect like what actually happened in his life. Like, the woman that's his girlfriend in the first few episodes is his actual girlfriend, or / still is. They may have gotten back together. Okay. I don't know. But these were real instances and like scenarios that happened in his life, because I went down this rabbit hole of researching how accurate the show was. I also thought the show was really good. And I mean, it's lighthearted in a sense, but also like kind of obnoxious. I enjoyed it. Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly right. And I really enjoyed it. Another show, this is like old, I mention it because it's maybe like it's kind of under the radar, and it's not usually my I don't really like absurdist humor. I don't like Monty Python. I don't know, like, this is sacrilege to some people, but I don't think it's funny. Like, I don't know. Like, right. I never know why The Knights Who Said Me was funny. I don't know if I've even chortled at Monty Python. But a show that I love that's like absurdist humor is the Eric Andre Show, which I think is also rerunning.
Yeah.
That's so funny. It's hilarious. So I recommend that. I don't know. My musical tastes are so juvenile. I don't know if it's even worth giving recommendations.
It's always worth it.
I don't normally give music recommendations.
It's always worth it. This is your chance. Convince our audience.
Well, I'm like trapped in like my high school years in terms of my musical taste. Like, I really love heavy metal. I've never stopped. I've really been getting into the whole discography, I think is the term, of this metalcore band, Every Time I Die, and they're old favorites. So if you like metal, you probably already know who they are. But I've rediscovered them after a couple of years off, and they're just incredible. So if you haven't given them a listen and you like metal, I highly recommend them.
Very cool. Well, on my end, on the reading front, I've discovered that the Arlington Public Library can send you free ebooks to your iPad and or Kindle. I have an iPad, so I've been getting some good books. In terms of fiction, I'm reading Life and Other Inconveniences right now by Krista Higgins. I'm about like halfway through, and it seems to be a little bit of a murder mystery novel slash the main character's child was abducted and or kidnapped and or already dead, but we're in like a setting like 20 years later right now, and she's still struggling over the loss of her child. On the TV and movie front, I just watched Eurovision, and it's the new Netflix
I was going to say, you watched all of Eurovision, like thing.
No,
watched the Fire Saga movie with Will Ferrell.
New Netflix movie with Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams. It was very Will Ferrell, if that's something you like. It really reminded me of Blades of Glory. Again, it was funny. It was lighthearted. And it was one of those films that you watched and you're like, why did I enjoy that? But it like also gave me good belly laughs. So I would recommend that if you want something a little bit more lighthearted. And then I'm still sticking to rewatching a lot of Survivor just because I find that entertaining. And I've said that multiple times now. But anyway, I'm still going because there's 40 seasons. Landry?
I have a few recommendations. I recently found an essay that I had read several years ago when I was towards the end of graduate school that I was looking at longform.org, which is they collect long form journalism and writing online and sort of publish best of lists. But one that I really, really enjoyed that I rediscovered recently is called, an essay called 52 Blue by Leslie Jamison, who wrote The Empathy Exams, if you've read that. And it's about the people that are fascinated with and sort of enamored by the whale that goes by the name 52 Blue. It's a whale that sings its whale song at 52 hertz, which is like totally different than any other whale of its species. And it has a hard time finding other whales and sort of swims through the ocean on its own and is sort of like a lonely animal compared to the others that the sort of swim in packs together. But it's more about the people that are kind of enamored with this whale and use it as a metaphor for like loneliness or depression or something. It's just really, really great and very well written. It's fascinating. It's called 52 Blue. I also would recommend, there are two TV shows that I would really, really like to recommend. One is called Review, and it ended a few years ago. It stars Andy Daly, who you would probably recognize because he's been in everything. But this is his one like starring role. He's been on Comedy Bang Bang and is a improv comedian, has a bunch of characters, but he plays a character that is a reviewer, but instead of reviewing books or movies or TV shows, he reviews life experiences. and in doing so, he takes it so seriously that he like completely ruins everything else in his life because he's not allowed to tell anyone what he's reviewing. So he gets assigned to review getting a divorce, for instance, in the second episode. And to do it with the most scientific rigor, he doesn't tell his wife that he's doing it for a review. So he just divorces his wife and then 2 weeks later is miserable and gives it one star. And it's not like everything goes back to normal at the end. The rest of the series is him dealing with the fallout of having divorced his wife for the review of the show. So these like terrible things that he's forced to review over the course of the show slowly accumulate and like ruin his life. But he takes it so seriously as his job that he really loves it. So it's very dark, but it's like a fun mockumentary style show. There's only like three seasons and they were all on Comedy Central, but it was not promoted at all. They did not do a good job of advertising it, but it is very funny if you're into kind of dark, dry humor.
I was going to say, I second that recommendation. I saw that show a couple of years. It's hilarious. It's a shame it never got more attention.
It's so great. I really, really recommend it to people. And it's a very easy watch. It's like 23 minutes an episode, and there's like 20 something of them. So very easy to do and very, very funny. And a lot of famous comedians are in it. Another show that you reminded me of, Chris, has Eric Andre in it, is called Man Seeking Woman. It was on FXX, and it is basically, it's about a man who is sort of down and out and has been broken up with by his girlfriend and his sort of various different, like dating escapades and trying to meet woman and live his life as sort of a late 20s man. But it takes a very, like, it takes an absurdist twist. So every episode has a sort of like trope that it plays up and really pushes it absolutely like to the limit. So for instance, in one episode, he's nervous about sending a text to a girl that he is trying to court. And he and his friend are debating whether he should send a follow-up text to be like, hey, did you get my message? And it starts as a normal sort of conflict between them and slowly escalates into they're in like a war room of like a military sort of scenario. And they're all standing around a table with a map and like making decisions in military uniforms saying like, he shouldn't send a second text. And like sort of discussing it like this. But every episode is a different kind of like media trope that they're playing on and sort of its own absurd thing. I highly recommend it. And then two albums have recently come out. Haim released The Women in Music Part 3, I think just last week. It's phenomenal. It's bright. It's summery. It will remind you of summer when you weren't locked indoors all the time. and Notes on a Conditional Form, which is by the 1975, that came out earlier this year. It's not, yeah. I would say, as good as their last album, A Brief Inquiry into Online Relationships, but I do enjoy it and think it's good, so it's worth a listen. If you're like me, you might not be able to see how everyone could mix up Ethan Hawke and Jude Law when one is clearly more handsome than the other. Or you didn't know that Andrew Niccol is also responsible for motion picture masterpieces like The Truman Show, The Terminal, and Stephenie Meyer's The Host. Whatever you think of Gattaca, though, make sure to keep the conversation going with us on Twitter at PopAndLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock with an E, Pod. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by me, Landry Ayers, as a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.